Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Joshua A. Douglas, professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law, and author of Vote for Us, capital U.S., How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on why he's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, whichever way you talk about that one, and Podomatic.com, Google Play, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Now, let me throw, as I always do, a plug for participation. Some of the organizations that I think are doing the best job of responding to the Trump administration and then pushing us forward beyond all of that is Indivisible.us. They've got about, over 5,000 local chapters and send you a weekly email at the start of the week telling you what's going on and calls you should make, meetings you should do, petitions you should sign on to, and so on. Two that were for a long time digital, but now are still digital, but working closely with grassroots organizations on a national level, MoveOn.org, MoveOn, one word, .org, and in California, Courage Campaign, one word, CourageCampaign.org. And then two that are very specific, one, fivecalls.org, that's the number five and the word calls, fivecalls, one word, .org, and they will tell you the most timely and relevant calls you might make at any time. And then Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representatives or nearby representatives are going to be holding meetings with the constituents, so you can go and let them know your thinking and know their thinking in person. And finally, just because climate change has been so on our minds this past, with Earth Day and all of that, 350. .org, probably the strongest national grassroots organization, activists working on climate change. And now to today's guest. I assume that listeners to this show and all those who care about democracy are well aware of the challenges presented by gerrymandering, by voter suppression, election manipulation, as well as the concerted efforts by Republicans to expand the negative impacts of those things. At least since the Supreme Court's unprecedented 2001 decision in Bush v. Gore, the image that embodies those efforts to me is that of the 20th century reaching up out of the grave, grabbing the future by the throat and saying, not so fast, not going without a fight. The Republican Party, its beliefs, its policies, while passionately held by millions, are no longer those of the majority of Americans, and so the only way they can survive and dominate is to game the system. Their voters are more likely to vote, especially in non-presidential elections, and they have strategically exploited that advantage to gerrymander electoral districts and pass laws to suppress voting, leaving us with Trump in the White House, GOP majorities in the Senate, the Supreme Court, and a majority of state legislatures and governorships. In the face of all this, Joshua Douglas has written a book about the many positive initiatives toward voting rights reform through which regular Americans are working to take back their democracy, one community at a time. Vote for Us includes chapters on expanding voter eligibility, easing voter registration rules, making voting more convenient, finding ways to comply with voter ID rules, giving redistricting back to the voters, improving civics education, and more. And the book includes a really useful and lengthy appendix that lists the organizations all over the country who are working on these efforts. Joshua A. Douglas teaches and researches election law and voting rights, constitutional law, and judicial decision-making at the University of Kentucky College of Law. And in addition to publishing in top law journals and popular media, he's a co-editor of Election Law Stories, which tells the behind-the-scenes tales of the major cases in the field, and the author of his recent book, Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Welcome, Joshua Douglas, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. Let me tell listeners we're recording this conversation Tuesday, May 7th.
Thanks, Terrence. It's great to be on.
Okay. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people that we are talking with, not just the ideas and the work, although that's all important. So can you tell us briefly about your path, the way you see it, to the work that you do today? And feel free to go way back. Mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. Let us get to know you a little bit.
Sure. So, you know, I've always been interested in elections and politics. And, you know, I remember back as a kid going to vote with my mom. You know, we had our elections typically in the school gymnasium used as a polling place. This is in Massachusetts. And so we had school like regular that day, except we didn't have gym class. And many kids were disappointed by that, but I remember sort of being excited about returning later on in the afternoon or evening with my mom to watch her vote. And so I think that really began a spark. In high school, I took a U.S. history class that was taught by an amazing teacher, Mark Gerstein, who has since passed away, who taught it kind of like a college course. I mean, he treated the high schoolers as if we were college students, really involving very vigorous reading and discussion. And then that led to a path of me going to college at George Washington University in D.C. and majoring in political science. While in D.C., I had the great opportunity to intern for both a U.S. senator and in the Clinton White House. And that was really eye-opening and very interesting experience. Then eventually I went to law school and took a class in voting rights law with a professor named Spencer Overton, who really is a main mentor who led me to the path toward studying voting rights, because it melded my new interest in law with my prior major in political science in undergrad. And I wrote a paper for him, and he basically said, this was good, and you should think about academia as a career. And that led me to the path now, where I've been a professor now for 9 years and just finished this book that I spent about 2.5 years on, a book for the general public about what's possible in voting rights.
Very good. Now, that's interesting, that tale you tell about youth. I do remember, you know, as a kid also, not necessarily going with my parents to vote, but just being excited about it. I don't know, you know, maybe civics education was better then, or maybe people were more positive, but I remember, yeah, that it was, election day was quite exciting.
And I remember, you know, I think it was the 1988 presidential election, where we had a mock election in the school as well. And in Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis was the nominee. And so I remember the class overwhelmingly voting for Dukakis, probably because he was from Massachusetts. But that's one of my first memories of an actual election that I got to essentially participate in as the mock election. But then I do recall, you know, every year was a big, important part of our annual ritual was to go to the elementary school where the polling place was located to vote.
Uh-huh. One question in that path you described. So you start out in Massachusetts, you go to college in D.C. How did you end up in Kentucky?
Yeah, so I went to college in D.C., then I moved up to New York City for about a year and a half and worked there before moving back to D.C. and doing some public policy before then ultimately going to law school at George Washington as well. Then I actually spent 3 years in San Antonio, Texas. I really wanted to work for a federal judge. It's kind of a prestigious position after law school to get a clerkship. And so I essentially applied nationwide and landed in San Antonio with an amazing judge named Ed Prado, who's actually now the U.S. ambassador to Argentina. Perhaps one of the only good decisions that President Trump has made is putting him as a U.S. ambassador, because he's a really great guy and is doing a really great job. So I spent 3 years in San Antonio and then wanted to enter academia. And essentially, you apply nationwide when you want to become a law professor and find the school that will want to hire you, and that's a good fit. And that was University of Kentucky. So I'm not a Kentucky native at all, although I've been here for 9 years. I've learned a lot about horses and bourbon that I didn't know previously. And so it's been a nice place to live. Lexington is a really nice college city.
Yeah. Yeah, and you guys had a very controversial decision last weekend.
Yeah, the Derby's was contested, and certainly the talk of the town, I guess the talk of the state and the country as well.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, Trump had to tweet his observations about that as well. Before we get into the good news in your book, I have to ask, I'm going to ask a few questions about the Constitution crisis that we seem to be facing, right? The Attorney General refuses to appear before a Senate committee for questioning. The Treasury Department refuses to turn over Trump's tax returns to another congressional committee. Are we in a constitutional crisis? And what, as you look at it, because I know your purview exceeds, it goes beyond just elections and voting. What is happening to our system of checks and balances?
Yeah, so as you note, you know, I teach constitutional law in addition to election law and voting rights, and I study the U.S. Supreme Court as well. With respect to checks and balances, you know, I think in some ways it's working. You know, when Trump became president, there were lots of concerns about some of the things that might happen, some of the potential authoritarian tendencies. And although we've had a lot of controversies, a lot of maybe scares, in many ways, you know, things haven't been as bad as many people predicted, at least, in terms of actual things being passed or being done. You know, certainly the public discourse is pretty terrible, and, you know, the U.S. has lost some standing in the international stage. But in terms of just the core checks and balances, I mean, on some things, Congress has been able to, you know, have some breaks on certain activities, and as well as the Supreme Court, not always and not all the cases, but in some things. And so I think we can say, okay, maybe the system is working a little bit better than maybe we had thought it might. On the other hand, of course, you know, you have this breakdown of trust and breakdown of norms. I mean, and this is even before Donald Trump. You know, think about Senator Mitch McConnell, my home state senator, refusing to allow the nominee of Obama's Supreme Court pick to even have a hearing. You know, someone who is eminently qualified, who surely would have been accepted by, you know, mainstream Democrats and Republicans. And he left that seat open, which really meant the Supreme Court changed for decades because of that brazen political act. So, you know, we are in a breakdown of, I think, not so much checks and balances as much as political norms and constitutional norms and the trust that used to be part of our system.
Yeah, I it's funny. My very next question began with, were Republicans refusing to consider Merrick Garland? So we're in sync there. It's this thing that I think a lot of people didn't realize until they're challenged or overrun, that much of what we have taken for the way the system works, you know, with all of its challenges, is about these norms. That some commentators that I've legal scholars that I've interviewed in the last couple of years have pointed out that the Constitution is, you could call it either a weak document or an open document. You know, it left a lot of room for these norms to actually play a role, and usually things went along. Talk just a little bit about that. Your view of what I've just suggested, that the Constitution is set up in a way to be open to this sort of overreach, and yet we've usually not had it. Now we do.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The Constitution is very open-ended in numerous ways, even from the simple thing that, you know, the First Amendment, which says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the speech. Well, what is speech? You know, the framers purposefully left things like that open-ended so that they could evolve with the times. And the breakdown of norms, I think, really calls some of that into crisis. It reveals the open-ended nature of certain constitutional provisions and checks and balances. But here's the other thing. I think that the framers and generations since have expected that when politicians broke well-known norms of political or constitutional activity, that the public wouldn't stand for it. And yet we see Mitch McConnell, as you note, you know, refusing to let Merrick Garland even get a hearing. And the public sort of, you know, or at least the left, sort of shrugged its shoulders. Now, maybe everyone just expected Hillary Clinton to win the 2016 election, and so it wouldn't have made a difference. But, you know, the right has done a really good job of making the judiciary a number one issue and doing whatever it takes to reshape the judiciary, because they know, they understand that Supreme Court decisions and even lower court decisions have such long-lasting impacts. You know, the Trump presidency will end in, you know, either a year and a half or you know, after a second term. But judges are there for life, and the Republican nominees are younger. They have very strong viewpoints, and the Republican Party was able essentially to reshape the judiciary in many ways through a breakdown of norms, and that's going to have really long-lasting effects. And the left has not understood that yet or figured out a way to counter it.
Yeah, let me just say a couple of things about that. One is that the Federalist Society, which I'm not sure you probably know exactly when it began to become a key player, but I see a lot of things go back to the Powell memo in the very early 70s and some of the things that came from that. And the Federalist Society has basically been teaching and grooming and supporting ultra-conservative justices and potential justices as a like the farm team to keep moving up the channels to ultimately the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court. And there's nothing that I know of that's anywhere close to that on the progressive or Democratic or left side.
Well, that's right in part that the Federalist Society has been very effective at espousing a particular ideology and then securing the halls of power, and it's an outgrowth in many ways of Antonin Scalia, who was one of the first founders of the Federalist Society. Now, there is a counter-movement or a counter-organization called the American Constitution Society, which is a progressive-leaning legal organization that espouses a broad understanding of the Constitution and, you know, has tried to be a counterweight. It's a younger organization, but it's growing. And I think, you know, it's not yet where the Federalist Society is, especially in terms of funding. I mean, the Federalist Society is very well-funded. But the ACS is a really great organization that I would encourage listeners to check out, especially lawyers, because it really does provide that needed balance, I think, in some of these legal discussions.
Yeah, I had Erwin Chemerinsky on recently, and his most recent book is exactly espousing and talking about both what would constitute a progressive view of the Constitution and what it will take to move that forward.
Yeah, and he's a great legal commentator and a real champion of a lot of these ideas on a broad constitutional sense. And so, you know, many law professors say when Erwin speaks, everyone should listen, and I think that's true.
Yeah. So a lot of these questions, I assume, are moving their ways through the courts and so on, will ultimately be decided by the Supreme Court. And as we mentioned, the Republicans refused to consider Merrick Garland, and then they one of the other points I wanted to make was that the Republicans have only won one national election since 1988. A lot of people probably don't realize that. 2004 is the only time that the Republicans have won the popular vote in a national election. By that, I mean the national election we hold is for president and vice president. And that an awful lot of these judges were appointed by either Bush and as you say, Trump's greatest effect on us may well be the judges being confirmed under him, both by presidents who did not win the popular vote. One of the quirks that I doubt, many people foresaw.
Yeah, you know, it is in many ways, you know, it will be his greatest legacy, and I think greatest, and when I mean largest legacy,
yeah.
And I think, that's really a legacy of both Trump and McConnell. But the other thing to note is that in reality, most of the judges that Trump is nominating and the Senate is confirming are fairly mainstream Republican choices. That is to say, if Jeb Bush, for instance, were the president, or Ted Cruz, the same nominees would likely be put forward, and that goes to the strength of the federal society and its influence. So, again, I look at the breakdown of the constitutional norms surrounding nominations brought upon by Mitch McConnell. Mm-hmm. You know, for lower court nominees, you had the what was known as the blue slip practice, where a home state senator could essentially object to a nominee, and that's now gone away.
Right, and that by the way, is one of those things that was a norm, not a law.
Absolutely.
But it was a norm that was practiced for decades, if not centuries.
On both sides.
Yeah.
And so in terms of the reshaping of the judiciary, you know, in my view, it's McConnell that is really at fault, way more than Trump. And really, McConnell, I think, has backed Trump because he, you know, McConnell's getting what he wants
right.
with respect to the judiciary.
Right. But the point I was making was that there are that judges are among, if not the only, among the only lifetime positions. And what we have is lifetime members of the judiciary side being appointed by folks who did not win. You say Cruz or Bush might have done the same nominees, but what I'm saying is someone who did not win the popular vote is appointing people who will serve for life. Just those two things together is kind of galling.
Yeah, well, you know, the law professor in me would push back a little bit and to say that although the Republican presidential winner didn't win the popular vote, they weren't running in an election that asked them to win the popular vote. So
that's right.
You know, although
that's right.
I fully understand the concern about a candidate winning the Electoral College and not the popular vote, and I do mention the Electoral College
sure.
at the end of the book, and I do personally think we should get rid of it, I don't think we can say, well, prior elections came out the wrong way because mm-hmm. they weren't running under a system where they were trying to get the most votes.
That's right. They played by the rules as they were, and they won by those rules. In terms of voting elections, You've studied and written about the positive reforms, and we're going to devote most of the rest of the time to them. But I want to ask how you assess the threat of Russian or other foreign interference in the upcoming 2020 election.
You know, it's hard to say, I think. Certainly Russia played a very sophisticated role in peddling what should be referred to as fake news, not what Donald Trump thinks is fake
right.
news, which is anything that's negative about him. But real fake news is, which is sort of a strange phrase to begin with, but it is stories that look real but are actually fabricated. And so I think there's a concern of that happening again with respect to social media. And it also appears that Russia hacked into various voter registration databases. They didn't get into voting machines or counting issues, that sort of thing. So we do need to shore up our security on those fronts. I guess I'm not all that concerned about Russia getting in and actually changing election results because, you know, they didn't in 2016, as far as we can tell at least. We're really focusing a lot of energy on that. So I think the biggest concern goes back to this, you know, changing of public perceptions
mm-hmm.
based on fake news.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one thing that occurs to me is that if the investigation that turned into the Mueller investigation, turned into, you know, what we're dealing with right now, if that had focused on Russian interference and not the Trump administration's cooperation with Russian interference, I wonder if we'd be further along in terms of fighting that threat.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's many people expected to see, you know, more robust findings from the Mueller report on that question than there were. You know, I'm not in a position to opine really about what else is out there that, you know, the experts who are looking at this didn't discuss. But again, I think we really need to educate the public to be much more careful about the sorts of things they're seeing and believing on social media and otherwise, because that really was what changed the tenor of the 2016 campaign, and that was very successful. So to me, that's the thing that the Russians would try to do again.
Yeah, and they've done it in other countries as well since then. What do you think? You point out that the Russians did not attempt to hack or hack into actual voting systems, as far as we know, although they, as you say, they were able to hack into databases, which means, you know, that doesn't bode well. But it wouldn't take Russians to hack electronic voting systems that lack verifiable auditable paper trails, would it?
No, I mean, yeah, of course, anyone could do that, and the concern of the security of election machines is, you know, not anything new in 2016, and so we definitely need to shore them up. Let me be clear, though, I'm not suggesting that I know for sure Russia did or didn't
right.
hack into voting systems. The evidence, you know, there hasn't been any evidence publicly disseminated that that's the case. But it's something that we need to be ever vigilant about. And, you know, honestly, election officials are being pretty vigilant about the security of their systems.
Good. That was my
election officials.
Yeah, that was my next question. Is there enough vigilance? Is there enough, people standing up for this? Because to me, that's a threat that's always been lying out there. As soon as we go to voting systems that lack paper trails.
Yeah, it's hard to say, but what I would say is that we should be continuing to use voting systems that have a paper trail, and many places are moving in that direction that don't have them already.
Good, good. Okay, so how did this book, Vote for Us, happen?
So, in a couple of ways. One, I really wanted to write a book for the general public because I feel like my work that is really focused in legal journals, speaking to other academics, lawyers, and judges, is only strong enough or is only usable enough if it's also relatable to the general public. And that's in part because of my work being about voting and democracy, which everyone cares about. I'd done a bunch of op-eds in various newspapers and media outlets and enjoyed the feedback I'd received from the general public. So I set out to write a book specifically for the general public to explain a lot of these things. And then the second thing that happened was I kept hearing about all of these positive stories about ways that people are working to actually improve elections and thought, no one's talking about that.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much doom and gloom when it comes to the right to vote. But yet I learned about all of these positive stories, and I felt like, you know, we're not embellishing them enough and really highlighting them. And if we're only pushing it back against doom and gloom, we're only getting halfway there.
Exactly. So this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Joshua A. Douglas, professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law, and the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. His website is Joshua A. Douglas, all one word, joshuaadouglas.com. And Josh, you've got some appearances coming up on the West Coast and a Twitter feed. Let us know those.
Yeah, so I'll be on the West Coast starting June 19th in San Diego, making appearances in San Diego, L.A., San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle, as well as some other places around the country. So you can find all of those dates on my website, joshuaadouglas.com, and click on Book Tour. And you can also find me on Twitter at Joshua A. Douglas.
Okay, very good. So you want to write a book for the public. You want to feature the good news, and I assume that underneath there is a little bit that if all you hear is doom and gloom, then that resignation that actually tends to keep people at home rather than bothering to vote are reinforced, whereas if they can feel like there's some good news, there's some good movement, maybe that increases the chance of actually using that vote. What did you hope to accomplish?
You know, I read a couple of books about voting rights, two different books written by journalists that really left me depressed because they're all about what's terrible in our system with no solutions or no, you know, sort of here's what we do next. And those books are great. One is Give Us the Ballot by Ari Berman. Another one is The Great Voter Suppression by Zach Roth. And I think those books are excellent. They do a great job of setting out what the problems are. But then I finished the book and thought, but now what?
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you know, I talk to a lot of people and I see things on social media of people being upset and wanting to do something. And so what do? They, you know, for example, wear red for Ed, right? Let's wear red T-shirts to support educators, which is great. I'm not criticizing that at all. But I do question, what change does that actually entail? What change does that actually accomplish? And so the hope of my book is that people understand that there's good news out there, that change is possible, and that it's happening, by everyday Americans. I'll say that again, that it's happening by everyday Americans working on the ground in communities all over the country. So really the goal here is to provide people hope and inspiration and then a game plan for actually becoming involved to change our system.
Okay. And by the way, I did interview Ari Berman on his book, Give Us the Ballot, and that podcast is available where my podcasts are, which is at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, or iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and about 20 other sites. I mean, just as I'm speaking to you and I'm raising, you know, the specter of one threat after another, you just are an optimist. Where does your optimism come from?
Yeah, I don't know where it actually comes from, although I agree that, you know, this is a very optimistic outlook and an optimistic book. You know, I think the optimism comes from the notion that what else could we do? I mean, yes, we have to fight back against the voter suppression, and the message here is not to stop any of that vital work. But in some ways, I feel like we play whack-a-mole, right? We beat back one negative law, and another one pops up in its place. And, you know, I'm not the type of person that wants to throw up their hands. I'm the type of person who says, okay, well, you know, what's next? Invoke one of my favorite TV shows, The West Wing, and President Bartlett, when he finishes something and he says, what's next?
Yeah.
And I think that's a great mantra, too, right? What can we do to actually improve the system and improve people's lives through making our democracy work a lot better than it does? And so, you know, one answer is to throw up our hands and say the system is rigged, to use the R word, and that, you know, the entrenched interests are always going to win. I think, no, let's figure out what the solutions are. You know, maybe they're incremental, but we can fix things to make them a lot better.
Right. And as much as I challenged you on your optimism, you know, anybody who titles their show A World That Just Might Work clearly has the same the same point of view, which is exactly that, which is what next? Okay, what do we do tomorrow? What do we do today, given what happened yesterday? Can you comment on what's happening in Florida, where the people voted to restore the right to vote to felons who've served their time?
Yeah, so this is a great example of a positive story that also is becoming a little bit negative right now, and so it demonstrates the push and pull or the expansions and contractions that we have to deal with. So Florida had one of the worst felon disenfranchisement laws in the country, disenfranchised felons for life, and the voters decided to change that. A lot of that was thanks to a guy named Desmond Mead, who had spent time in prison. He got out. He still kind of was in really bad shape. He actually almost committed suicide, but then he eventually cleaned up his life. He even went to law school. And he went to law school knowing that the state would not let him sit for the bar exam. And so after law school, he decided to try to change the state's democracy by creating a new organization called the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, with the mantra of second chances, to try to allow, as he puts it, returning citizens and give them the right to vote back as soon as they finish their sentences. And so they waged a vigorous campaign, and they ultimately won. In Florida, you need 60% approval to have a state constitutional amendment, and it passed. And so that re-enfranchised about 1.4 million Americans. Now, the Florida legislature is trying to push back against that. They are in the process of passing a new law that would say that you aren't eligible for that rights restoration if you have any outstanding fines from any conviction in the past, misdemeanor, whatever. You know, and many people would say, well, doesn't that kind of sound like a poll tax? You're saying you have to pay money to be able to get your right to vote back? Yes, the answer is yes on that. And so there are lawyers preparing lawsuits that I think ultimately will probably be successful to, you know, make it such that this new law doesn't re-disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things you point out there is the push and pull, is the back and forth. And it was my understanding, and why I think optimistic as you are, that ultimately this new law, which kind of pulls the good news back, may not stand, is that the folks involved in writing that constitutional amendment ballot initiative made it one, that it went into effect immediately. There were certain things they did, having learned the lessons of initiatives that have been, taken apart afterwards, that I thought they had done. I mean, everything I had read said they had made it about as airtight as you could, that what the voters voted for would be what happened.
Yeah, and, saying that you have to pay back all fines and fees, which would have the effect of, I forget the numbers, but hundreds of thousands of people would not be able to regain the right to vote back. Many people who have actually already registered under the new law, it's just clearly against the intent of the voters who passed this initiative. And, they campaigned on this issue of re-enfranchising 1.4 million Floridians who have served their time. To take half of that away, I think would be, or whatever the numbers are, think would be fairly absurd, and I suspect the courts will see that. But again, we can only go forward with positive reforms at the same time as pushing back against voter suppression, and we need to do both.
Yeah, you got to play defense and you got to play offense.
Yeah, but too often I think we only play defense.
I know.
And that's one of the big messages of my book, is that, no, we also have to play offense at the same time. Not
right.
Not only, but both have to happen.
Right. And I would say that message applies, and I'm sure you agree with me, way beyond, questions of voting. It applies all across the board. And it's why, for instance, Naomi Klein, book, No Is Not Enough. Defense will only keep you treading water.
I think that's right, although I would argue that perhaps it's most important and most fundamental when it comes to democracy reform, because everything starts with the way we elect our officials. I tell my law school colleagues that my class, election law, is the most important course in the whole curriculum, because their classes, whether it's criminal law or contracts or whatever, don't exist without my class first.
Right.
You need people to elect legislators to pass the laws that they're then teaching. And so I think this notion of playing offense is probably, in my view, most important when we come to the very foundation of our democracy.
Yeah, for about the last 15 years, I've been advocating for something which I think falls right into your book, which is the restore democracy trifecta of media reform, election reform, and campaign finance reform.
Yeah, absolutely.
How we fund them,
chapters,
how we deal with the facts of them, and then how we actually vote.
Yeah, so I have a chapter specifically on civics education. I have a chapter specifically on campaign finance reform. And I have multiple chapters on how the voting process works. And what they do is they all highlight positive stories, changes that are already happening. We talked about the Electoral College briefly. I spend a little bit of time on it, but not a ton, because the point of the book is to look at success stories already happening on the ground in communities all over the country. And, there is a movement to reform the Electoral College, but what I want is a community in, anywhere, somewhere in California, to say, oh, it's working over there, so we can do it as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's just go take another minute with the Electoral College. It's the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact seems to be the biggest movement to deal with that, because the assumption is that incumbents in states who are made more powerful by the Electoral College are never going to vote to do away with it or reform it much. Tell people what the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is, where it stands, and if it were to succeed, when you suspect that might be.
Yeah, so the plan essentially is for each state that wants to sign on to say that instead of awarding their Electoral College votes to the winner in their state, they'll give their Electoral College votes to the winner nationwide. Let's say that in Kentucky, where I am, if it were to sign on, which is unlikely, but just to use it as a hypothetical, Kentucky would say, even if a Republican wins our state of Kentucky, if a Democrat wins the national popular vote, we'll award our 8 Electoral College votes to that national popular vote winner. It's passed about a dozen states or so, and the laws in each of these states don't go into effect until enough states have passed it to equal 270 Electoral College votes, which is the number needed to win. It's in about a dozen states that equal about 180 some odd Electoral College votes, so they're well on their way, but not there yet. And it's passed mostly Democratic-leaning states, although the latest was Colorado to pass it, and that's sort of thought of as a purple state.
Right.
In terms of its, you know, likelihood of passage, I really think what would need to happen is a Republican candidate winning the popular vote, but not the Electoral College, which actually almost happened in 2004.
I know.
And if that had happened, I think there would have been a lot more movement on this. But, you know, I think at this point, when it's only passing in the Democratic-leaning states, that may not be enough to equal 270. And then if it does pass enough, it's going to go to the courts.
Sure.
Because I think there are some serious constitutional questions about whether the plan is constitutional with the Electoral College in the Constitution
yep.
itself, and this is really a workaround
yep.
of that.
Yeah, and then we've talked about how the courts might lean. I want to do one more thing. We talked about felons. What about prisoners voting? Some have come out recently, and I believe you have talked about this, advocating those currently serving time in prison be allowed to vote. What's the history of that issue and its current standing?
Yeah, so this has, you know, obviously been an issue in the Democratic nomination battle right now. I think Bernie Sanders was the first one to come out and say that he thinks we should allow prisoners to vote. You know, prisoners can vote already in two states, Vermont and Maine,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think anyone thinks democracy there is broken. And in fact, those who are in prison but not yet convicted are still eligible to vote as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually do allow prisoner voting in lots of places where someone may be incarcerated, awaiting trial or whatnot. You know, the history of prisoner voting and the history of felon disenfranchisement are intertwined. They all come from, during Reconstruction, post-Civil War moves to disenfranchise newly freed slaves and African Americans in general. It's a Jim Crow history, a racist history, that has racist effects to this day,
mm-hmm.
where a large percentage of people who are disenfranchised are racial minorities. You know, I look at this in terms of the fundamental right to vote, and we think of the right to vote as the most important right of citizenship. And when we put someone in prison for committing a crime, we take away a lot of their rights, but we don't take away their citizenship.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of good reasons to support the ability of prisoners to vote, or at least to never take the right to vote away to begin with. I mean, I'm not sure why we're tying committing a crime to
mm-hmm.
the act of being a citizen through voting. Now, the book does not advocate for this because, again, it's looking at success stories.
Yep, yep.
And so it really focuses on the places that have eased their felon disenfranchisement laws fulfilling all
serving
the
requirements your time,
yep. of sentence. But, as an academic question, I think that the history plus the fundamental nature of voting rights, you know, suggest that maybe Maine and Vermont have it right here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and one thing I wanted to mention when we talked about 1.4 million getting their franchise in Florida is to remember that the 2000 election, Bush v. Gore, when the count was stopped and it went to the original vote, was won by 537 votes.
Yeah, and even the 2016 election was relatively close.
That's right.
Trump won it by 100 and some odd thousand votes.
A very populous state with a swing state, with a huge Electoral College impact. So, those 1.4 million could make all the difference in a national election. You write about a lot of the reform efforts by focusing on the stories of the individuals. It's really a hallmark of your book. And you spoke about one, the gentleman who was a force behind that felony reenfranchisement in Florida. Could you tell a couple more?
Sure. One of my other favorite stories from the book comes from the redistricting chapter and Michigan's push to take the power away from the politicians to draw lines and place it with the voters. And this started because of a young woman named Katie Fahey. She's 27 years old at the time. And 2 days after the 2016 election, she posted on Facebook and said, "Hey, I'm kind of thinking of taking on redistricting in Michigan. Anyone want to join in?" Smiley face. And she says the smiley face is very important. She had no political experience. She'd worked for the Michigan Recycling Coalition. And she said she posted it because she was kind of fed up, not necessarily with their election results, but just with the tenor of the country at that time. And really, she said she was afraid to go to Thanksgiving dinner because her family is politically split. So she thought, you know, she'd post this, some family members and friends might respond. They'd all go find an organization to join. Well, a funny thing happened. Not very many people that she knew responded, but a whole bunch of people started sharing the post. First a dozen, then hundreds, then thousands. And people kept contacting her and saying, yes, I want to be involved. What can I do? So she ended up starting a whole new organization called Voters Not Politicians. They went all around the state, held meetings to talk to people about what should go into gerrymandering or redistricting and to avoid gerrymandering. They talked about, you know, what does your community think of when you define yourselves? Is it school board lines or school district lines? Is it county lines? Is it something else? They gathered over 100,000 signatures in about 90 days without having any paid canvassers, which is unheard of. They got a ballot initiative on the ballot for 2018, and it passed overwhelmingly to create an independent redistricting commission in Michigan. And so now, instead of having the politicians draw the lines and to gerrymander themselves to stay in power, an independent commission is going to do it after the 2020 census, and the next round of redistricting starts in 2021.
And that makes such a difference. It's interesting, in California, which was one of the early states to switch to a citizens redistricting, it was a big celebrity and governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was sort of the leading figure, although, you know, not the originator of that. But to have just an individual put up a post and have it turn into what will change that state. Another story.
Yeah, and she says, I titled the chapter this because I thought it was so poignant. She said, we were overthrowing the government peacefully. And it really was just one person and a Facebook post.
Wow. By the way, I think that's how the women's marches happen too. But they don't have the effect that this does. Another story, another individual.
One of my favorite chapters among all of my favorites is about civics education, because I think this is not talked about a lot and yet surprising. And so the person I profile at the beginning of that chapter's name is Jen Hitchcock, a social studies teacher in Virginia. And, you know, when I started writing that chapter, I thought that civics education was on the decline, by and large, and that what did exist was just rote memorization of facts or, you know, let's learn about the checks and balances, which, to be honest, for a 16 or 17-year-old or younger, it's probably not the most exciting thing. You know, I may like it being a constitutional law professor, but I'm not sure most high school students are enthralled by learning about checks and balances. But what Jen Hitchcock does is engage her students in real-world problems. You know, she does what's known as action civics. So they debate things like voter ID laws or campaign finance. And she requires them to write policy papers that present both sides of the issues. She grades them only on the quality of their arguments, not on how they come out. And they tackle real-world problems. They talk about guns in schools and policies involving gun rights. Another school that I profile in that chapter comes from Washington, D.C. This is a magnet school, a public school that draws from all over the city. And the students there realized that their classmates were tardy pretty often to school. So they decided to investigate why, and they learned that essentially transportation was not very, very reliable for many of these students. So they came up with a plan. They went to the D.C. city government and convinced them to allow students to have free public transportation. And so now in Washington, D.C., any district resident who's under whatever age, I forget the exact age it is, but any student essentially can obtain a kids ride free card to use the public transportation. Now, I can't imagine any of those students will ever forget the importance of engaging in their democracy through real-world action, and that's so powerful.
Wow, that's great. I mean, I got one of the, you know, where you sort of get a little chill and you're moist up just as you were telling it, even though I knew the story. And I'm going to jump from that one to there are efforts in California and elsewhere to lower the voting age to 16. And before I go to this, I want to share a personal story, Josh. In 1972, the voting age was lowered from 21 to 18, right? And that was a big step. The logic being if they were old enough to fight in Vietnam, they were old enough to vote. And I was 24 at the time, been out of college 2 or 3 years, and I got involved with the McGovern campaign. I ended up running an assembly district in L.A. County for McGovern, and it was the most conservative Democratic assembly district in California. That is to say, it wasn't San Diego where, you know, it was a Republican district, but it was a very labor-oriented, conservative. It was the silent majority within the Democratic Party. And I think they saw me coming. You know, I was a kid from Massachusetts, and they said, oh, go there, run that district. It didn't have a college. It had 250,000 people, population, but didn't have a college, didn't have an affluent neighborhood, didn't have the usual places that you go to for progressive voters. What I did was I would call the Nixon headquarters, and I'd say, I'm thinking of setting up a debate in the local high school. Will you send someone to debate me? So I'm 24, and they send whoever they send. And I did that all over the district because it certainly had high schools. And almost all my volunteers were kids from those high schools. They did the canvassing. They did the work. And, you know, we didn't end up winning that district. But we got the same percentage in that conservative district that McGovern got in the country. We exceeded what they wanted us to get by a great deal. So I you know, this is near and dear to me. Is the public ready for 16-year-old voters?
Well, the public is ready in the places that have done it. You know, there are at least a dozen cities that have lowered the voting age to 16 for local elections. And I advocate this on the local side first, because what I want is people to try it out, to see it working in their local communities. Mm. And that's going to, I think, generate broader support for this idea. So it started in Tacoma Park in Maryland in 2013. Thanks to the advocacy of both an innovative city council member named Tim Mail and some local youths who were really engaged in the issue. And you know, your story demonstrates, you know, young people are amazing advocates for this country, for the future, and for themselves. And every place that has lowered the voting age to 16 for either local or school board elections has had young people at the forefront of the debates. So Tacoma Park did it, and then moved to Hyattsville, Maryland, a slightly more conservative place that agreed to lower the voting age. Greenbelt, Maryland, hopped across the country, and Berkeley, California, lowered its voting age for school board elections to 16, which should take effect, I believe, in 2020. San Francisco came close in 2016. It voted, it lost 52-48, but that was a big jump from the initial polling, which suggested it would only get about 36% of the vote, which demonstrated that through education, people changed their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw the Los Angeles School Board approved a feasibility study to look at lowering the voting age to 16 for its school board elections. So yeah, is the country ready? Is the public ready? I think at the local scale, once they hear all of the arguments in favor of it, it makes a lot of sense, and it's really working. And I'll just add two more things really quickly. One, this reform can create a whole new generation of engaged voters. If we want to improve voter turnout and both, you know, couple that with civics education, have an educated, engaged electorate, 16 makes a lot more sense than 18. And two, this works. In the cities that have lowered the voting age and implemented already, turnout among 16 and 17-year-olds is typically about double that of 18 to 29-year-olds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what makes sense to me is that that's when you're studying it, that's when it's kind of fresh and new and so on. And so if you can begin to build a habit of actually having power on your built on your foundation of knowledge, you, as advertisers know and products know, if you can grab people when they're young, you will may have them forever. So if democracy can give these people a vote when they're young, democracy may have them forever.
Yeah, you know, studies show that voting is habit forming.
Yep.
That one of the biggest predictors of whether you're going to vote is whether you voted previously.
Sure.
And that non-voting is habit-forming, too. If you
yeah.
miss the first election when you're an eligible voter, you're much less likely to become a habitual voter. And 18 is kind of a strange time to start the voting process. You
mm-hmm.
know, you're moving out of the house, you're
yeah.
in the workforce, or going to college. We make you jump through all of these hoops, you know, whether it's registration, request an absentee ballot, et cetera. You've got all these other changes going on. But 16, you know, we know where they are, so we can get everyone registered, we can educate them appropriately, and we can create this culture of democratic engagement, it just makes a lot more sense.
And they probably will have effect on their parents who probably have less time to put into knowing what's going on than those kids do. And of course, there's the experience that the country has seen with Parkland and that the world has seen with Greta Thunberg and various other kids in Europe and America. It seems to be a moment where young people are showing they have the sense to do this.
Yeah, you know, and actually, to your point about parents, a study in Scotland showed that lowering the voting age to 16 for Scottish elections actually improved turnout among the parents as well, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
Now, the common pushback I receive, which you may have been about to ask, is about the maturity, right? The number one objection I hear is, oh, they're not mature enough yet. So I always want to make sure I add that I looked into studies of cognitive brain development because that's such a common objection, and actually it's question I had when I first heard about it as well. I wasn't completely sold at first. And what I learned is that psychologists essentially, somewhat simplified, but break cognition into two camps. They call it hot cognition and cold cognition. And hot cognition is kind of impulse control, peer pressure situations, heat of the moment. And psychologists say the brains are not developed for that until at least age 21 and maybe not 24 or 25. Cold cognition, by contrast, is slower decision making, not heat of the moment, not peer pressure in the moment. And psychologists say that brains are fully developed for cold cognition by age 16. And if you think about, you know, the things that we allow 16-year-olds to do and the Parkland students, as you mentioned, this actually makes a lot of sense.
That is great to hear. Yeah, exactly. That you want to root it, because I will confess, before I picked up your book, Josh, there is a bill, I think, information in California beyond the LA City Council or the LA School Board to do a number of reforms, and one of them is lower the voting age to 16. And I had been hesitant to sign on, and to advocate for it because I felt, oh, people aren't going to be ready for that. It may take down the other reforms. So it is good to get what you're supplying, which is backing for that piece of a larger reform message. We've got,
yeah, and what the campaigners found in San Francisco is that education really does make a difference. That once people start to learn about it, they change minds. You know, they have a knee-jerk reaction. Many people do against the idea because 18 is so entrenched in our society. But once they start to learn about the merits and understand the responses to the common objections, many people's minds will change.
Yeah, and that's exciting. Okay, we've got about a minute and a half. Your thing of, besides picking up your book, Vote for Us, besides looking at the appendix and finding organizations that that are working on issues they might care about, what would you tell listeners to do?
Well, talk to your kids if you have kids about politics. Bring them to the voting booth. Do take a look at the appendix because I have a list of about three or four organizations in every state working on democracy reform, as well as the second half of the appendix has national organizations. And there's organizations you probably haven't heard of, you know, groups like Vote Riders that works to ensure everyone has an ID. You know, voter ID laws are not going away, but we can reduce their negative effects if we make sure everyone has an ID. And groups like Vote Riders and another group called Spread the Vote are working on those sorts of issues. Subscribe to your local newspaper. Local journalism will save our democracy, but only if we give them the support. So that's another step that I think is vitally important. And then continue the conversation about positive voting rights reforms. Pick one of these ideas, you know, whether it's redistricting reform, campaign finance, ranked choice voting, which we didn't get the chance to talk about, but I have a chapter on it, and talk to your neighbors about the merits of these and try them out.
Okay, wonderful. So again, the book is Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. The website is joshuaadouglas.com, Joshua A. Douglas. So there's two A's right in the middle of that. Don't think you made a typo if you put it down that way. You've got West Coast appearances coming up and a Twitter handle. Hand that to folks.
Yep, the West Coast is in the middle of June. You can get all the dates at my website, joshuaadouglas.com/, and click on Book Tour. Twitter handle is at Joshua A. Douglas. I'm pretty active on there.
Okay, and the other thing is he does articles and posts sort of on a pretty regular basis. So if you get to the website, he's doing stuff for CNN and other folks on a regular basis. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or a world that just might work. To the same website, terrencemcnally.net, it is all these words in a row, a world that just might work.com. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement, it tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles that I choose to flesh out the conversation, adding examples and context, that sort of thing, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, and as I said, a number of others. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at those other sites. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, etc. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Josh Douglas. Keep up the good work.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.